dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. Of course, very much in the forefront of that war at the moment is the battle space of Ukraine. I'm very pleased that we have with us someone who has spent a prodigious amount of time traveling in and through Russia and other parts of the former Soviet Union, and has developed in the course of it a tremendous understanding of the nature of the challenge that we're facing. He is Herman Perchner, the founder and president of the American Foreign Policy Council, a very highly regarded institution here in Washington, D.C. He contributes mightily to the national security debate, and he contributed to a very thoughtful early warning on what Vladimir Putin is up to, entitled Reviving Greater Russia, the Future of Russia's Borders with Belarus, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Moldova, and Ukraine, about 10 years ago now. Herman Perchner, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
Thank you. Well, look, we have in the news today the announcement that out of negotiations that took place in Geneva yesterday between the American Secretary of State, John Kerry, his Russian counterpart, Lavrov, and leaders of the foreign policy establishments of Ukraine and the European Union, a deal has been struck. Tell us about the nature of the deal and whether there's, well, any there.
Well, the claims are that there's an agreement that all the forces occupying buildings illegally will be pulled back by the end of the week.
This is in eastern Ukraine, of course.
Yes, in Ukraine. But it looks so shaky, even President Obama was pulling away from it. And I note two other things. There are already differences in the interpretations of the agreement that are coming from Moscow and coming from Washington. And perhaps more importantly, at the time they were negotiating, President Putin of Russia was talking about his right to go into and use force in Ukraine, and specifically in the southeast regions that were once called Nova Russia.
New Russia, in other words. And what this conveys, Herman, I guess, is the kind of backdrop to the present crisis that caused even President Obama to sort of lowball the expectations that any useful upshot would come of this. Give us a flavor of specifically, and you've studied him closely, you've met with him, what Vladimir Putin's agenda is here as you see it.
Well, I think at the minimum he wishes to reunite the Slavic parts of the former Soviet Union. That would be all of Ukraine, that would be Belarus, that would be part of northern Kazakhstan. There are others in his circle that are more ambitious than that and wish to take more territory. But we shouldn't underestimate how deeply they feel about their neo-imperialist ambitions. If you read their writings over 10 years of the people surrounding Putin, for instance, Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin, you understand this is a fixed idea, and they're not likely to give it up at the bargaining table until they meet some force or some resolute action from the West. They will continue to be aggressive.
Are you struck, Herman Perchner, as am I, by some of the eerie and very troubling parallels between what is playing out at the moment? In fact, even the language that Vladimir Putin is using, to say nothing of the sort of techniques to justify or at least rationalize the insertion of forces in Crimea first, and now it appears into eastern Ukraine as well, and the likelihood that, as you say, there will be more of this to come, both in Ukraine and perhaps elsewhere.
Well, yes. If you look at what happened, for instance, in Czechoslovakia between February and October 1938, there are enormous parallels. The Hitler's claim that you have to protect German citizens when German citizens were not at risk, is roughly the same as Putin saying he has to protect Russian citizens, which were never at risk. The bullying of the Czech Republic is similar to the pressure the West is now putting on Ukraine to accept things that would put the independence of Ukraine at risk. Many, many parallels from that time, all disturbing.
Herman, one of the things that you've alluded to that is, of course, disturbing as well is the lack of resolution on the part of the West. It is riven clearly between Europeans who are both very much in the thrall of Russia as a result of their dependency on its energy supplies, and have in other ways become entangled with Russian businesses and trade arrangements and the like, and therefore are very reluctant to impose much in the way of sanctions. And military options have been very explicitly taken off the table, apart from some maneuvers of jets and so on over the Baltic states and the like. Give us a flavor of where things stand at the moment, as you see it, with respect to resolve in Europe, to say nothing of here in Washington, to contest what Putin evidently has in mind.
The Russian establishment, led by Putin, simply believes the West has no appetite to stop him. And, you know, there's an old Arabic saying that says, how did you become pharaoh? And the answer is, because nobody stopped me. Putin thinks nobody will stop him, and those feckless people in the West that think they can buy peace by surrendering, making talk and doing nothing, only increase the likelihood of a serious war, and they may embolden Putin to step up his aggression to the point where we end up with something very, very nasty.
Yeah. I wanted to actually to get your thoughts on a comment that one of our colleagues, Dan Garay of the Lexington Institute, said in a meeting I was at this week. Specifically, Herman Pirchner, that what the West has done so far is to take steps that have had the effect of putting enough forces into play to create a crisis, but not enough to prevent a crisis, to prevent a conflict, more importantly. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, our late friend Dr. Fritz Kramer had the term provocative weakness, and this is a great example. By looking so weak, we invite aggression. I disagree a little bit with the formulation you mentioned, because even if the West did nothing, Putin is going to continue to be aggressive, even more aggressive. And there will come a point where he'll have to be stopped one way or the other. The sooner we look like there's resolve, the better the chance there will be a pause in Moscow where they say, well, maybe we'll digest Crimea and other things, and maybe over time the situation becomes better. But he's not going to stop with words. He may pause, but he's not going to stop.
Yeah. Well, I think, in fairness to Dan, I think his admonition was that we ought to be doing more. But just, Herman, in the 2 minutes or so we have left, what specifically would you recommend the West do now, most especially the United States, do now to disabuse Putin of this sense of provocative weakness on our part and hopefully dissuade him from further actions in Ukraine and elsewhere?
There are plenty of Ukrainians that are ready to fight. The Russians understand that. They remember the guerrilla war in Ukraine for a long time after World War II that the Soviets had a difficult time putting down. We should be giving arms, defensive arms, especially to people that would wage a guerrilla war in Ukraine. That's a big deterrent to Russia coming in. You know, the average guy in the Russian army may come in fighting based on Russian propaganda, but eventually they'll understand how their government has lied to them, and they may not have an appetite for killing Ukrainians the way they do for killing Chechens and others in the North Caucasus. So a guerrilla war really could bring this thing to a stop based on lack of resolve and lack of real animosity between average Ukrainians and average Russians.
Well, we're at the moment confining ourselves to, as I understand it, providing them meals ready to eat. I call it meals ready to eat for a country ready to be eaten, and even other defensive gear like body armor and night vision goggles and so on is considered to be, as we'll be talking about with Bill Gertz shortly, sufficiently provocative that the administration won't have it. Herman Perchner, we appreciate your counsel. Your trips, some 60 of them to Russia, have made you a go-to guy on this subject. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Next up, we're going to talk with Catherine Zimmerman of the American Enterprise Institute about a Yemen gathering of Al-Qaeda, what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors.
Dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families, retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Catherine Zimmerman. She is the senior analyst and Al-Qaeda and Associated Movements team lead at the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, one of the duty experts in Washington on what is happening with these Islamists seemingly determined to destroy this country. Catherine Zimmerman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
It's great to be on here again.
Thank you. Listen, you have covered in an important posting at AEI's blog site earlier this week an event that took place in Yemen with the title, quote, "If we're not winning in Yemen, are we really winning against Al-Qaeda?" unquote. Talk a little bit about this event in Yemen and why it gives rise to cause for concern.
What's come out of Yemen is a video that Al-Qaeda's franchise there, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, released on Twitter at the end of March. And that video is very concerning for a variety of reasons. First, it shows Al-Qaeda's top leadership in Yemen out in the open, relatively at ease, no concern for safety, meeting with over 100 different fighters. Second, it also shows individuals who were broken out of prison in February rejoining the militant group. And then third, simply, is kind of the brazenness of the video, where you have this large gathering of individuals, and there is no sign of any kind of Yemeni or American counterterrorism presence. So we're seeing them able to operate relatively freely and throwing that back in our face.
Including, in the course of the video, making some rather direct threats to the United States.
Certainly. And one part that I missed was that there are certain individuals in the video whose faces have been obscured. So to me, that indicates that we might be seeing some people of value at this meeting, and maybe that there's some operational plot underway, and that's why that they want to protect their identities.
And operational plots, of course, have emanated from this group, Al-Qaeda, in the Arabian Peninsula in the past, very narrowly averting some terrible damage to this country. And there's probably, as you say, Catherine Zimmerman, more in the works as we speak. We're visiting with Catherine Zimmerman of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, where she monitors Al-Qaeda and associated movements. She's one of the authors of Defining the Enemy, a very important study that the AEI did last September. And I want to come back to that, but Catherine, just before we leave Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the suggestion is that our counterterrorism operations in Yemen are now no longer sufficient even to be aware of what adversaries like these are doing, let alone to be taking them out. Is that your reading of this, the message of this video in part?
It's not clear to me whether the American intelligence community knew about this meeting or not. There are a variety of reasons why they would let it go on and would not acknowledge that they did have foreknowledge of what this gathering was. But what is clear is that even if we had conducted a drone strike in Yemen and killed the top leaders, that's only a short-term gain for the United States. Al-Qaeda has proven it's able to replace these leaders again and again. It has a large bench from which to pull, essentially. And drone strikes are not a strategy. The other side of our strategy in Yemen has been relying on the Yemeni security forces. They have suffered regular casualties at the hands of AQAP and really haven't pushed against the group since June 2012. So we're looking at almost a year and a half now, or over that, that Al-Qaeda has really been under pressure in Yemen. That's a problem when we're looking at the network globally, too.
Yeah. And I wanted to turn to that next. We've had the chairman of the House and Senate intelligence committees, Mike Rogers, the Republican in the House, and Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat in the Senate, both agree on numerous occasions now that actually the threat from Al-Qaeda is worse today than it was prior to 9/11. Would you agree with that characterization? And if so, is that a function of the extent to which this notion that there is an Al-Qaeda core that we should be preoccupied with is really been completely overtaken by events?
I believe the threat from Al-Qaeda is much higher today than it was a few years ago, and I don't have background to assess it before 9/11. But what's very different is that the organization has changed. It's more diffuse, it's more decentralized, but all of these different groups that we hear about, the group in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Somalia, and the Sahel, each of them are able to and desire to attack the United States as part of their longer-term strategy. So just focusing on the group in Pakistan means that we're only fighting a fraction of the network, and that's why the threat actually is quite high today. We've ignored most of it.
Yeah. Boy, that's a chilling thought. And when you combine it with the president's pronouncements in the course of the campaign that al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat, it really represents, it seems to me, Catherine Zimmerman, national security fraud that was perpetrated on the American people. But going back to your paper on defining the enemy, I just want to see if, in a way, it's not even worse than what you've just described, which is that al-Qaeda has metastasized and is more dangerous today than it was even a few years ago, let alone before 9/11. And that is whether we're clear that al-Qaeda is just one part of an even larger element of enemies that we confront. There are very different ways of describing them. But do you accept the proposition that the focus on al-Qaeda, even if we get it properly defined as a broader movement, is only a part of the problem that we're facing from Islamists bent on our destruction?
There is an issue with militant Islamists who are looking to impose their views by the use of violence. The problem with al-Qaeda is that it is a force multiplier, and it's learned to work with these various groups in Syria, also in Mali, that are operating on the ground under different names, and they're not calling themselves al-Qaeda. So it's become much more challenging for us today to actually see the extent of the al-Qaeda network's reach into the militant Islamist movement.
But I guess what I'm getting at, Catherine, is that if what is really animating al-Qaeda, or for that matter, the Muslim Brotherhood, or, you know, Jamaat Islamiya, or any number of other enterprises which may or may not explicitly affiliate with al-Qaeda or describe themselves as franchise operations, if you will, are nonetheless very much a mortal threat to us because to the extent that they seek to achieve this this grand design of imposing this doctrine they call Sharia worldwide and creating a caliphate to rule according to it, and we stand in the way of that and therefore are their enemy, we're missing the true character of, as you put it, defining the enemy. In a way that almost certainly enables much of it to operate with impunity while we're focusing on whether it's Pakistani, al-Qaeda, or other subsets of that larger problem.
That is an issue. There is a movement to actually reshape the world as we know it today in order to have Sharia dominate across the globe and not just in defined Muslim lands as we would see them. But I would be careful about which groups we throw in there. Because there are definitely Islamist groups that are seeking to achieve this change through the political system, which I see as a valid way to make progress. My fear is are those that turn to violence, and that's really where we have the threat coming from today.
Well, this is a subject for a longer conversation. Perhaps we, I think, confront in the Muslim Brotherhood a group that will use political processes to the point where it is necessary, but when it is no longer necessary, are perfectly prepared, as we see with their Hamas operation in the Palestinian areas, to use violence. And we'll, I'm afraid, confront more of that as they become stronger in various parts of the world, perhaps even including here. Catherine Zimmerman, thank you for the work you do at the American Enterprise Institute with the Critical Threats Project, and for your writings and commentary, and I hope you will come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Quetta Ahmed about honor diaries and the same problem of what the Islamists are up to against women. Straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk. Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. When President Obama removed the last U.S. troops from Iraq in 2011, he declared that the war there was over. This statement, like so many others from Team Obama over the years, is proving as predicted to be national security fraud. Yesterday, the Iraqi government announced it has closed the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. The reason? It could be overrun at any time by al-Qaeda jihadists who now control much of the surrounding Anbar province. The presence of murderous enemies of this country in parts of Iraq from which they were expelled at great expense by American forces means that, far from being on the path to defeat, al-Qaeda and a host of other Islamists are on the march. And that means the war against them is anything but over. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Quanta Ahmed. She is a woman who has come to considerable public attention of late as a contributor to a very important film. It's entitled Honor Diaries by the Clarion Project, and it examines in a most impressive way, to my way of thinking, the challenge that women in particular are facing in many Islamic societies and the practices that are associated with it that are, well, misogynistic, I guess is the technical term, certainly oppressive of women. And she has, for her troubles, come under a great deal of criticism from those among the Muslim American apparatus, specifically, I think many of it is those associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, for her clarity on the various challenges that women, among others, are facing at the moment from Sharia. Welcome, Dr. Ahmed. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks.
You have a background, of course, in much of this as a result of being an observant Muslim. You're also a medical doctor. I want to sort of get at the thrust of this film and the questions that it raises about practices that run the gamut from the rights that women are afforded in many of these traditional Muslim societies and some horrors that they're subjected to, from child marriage to honor killings to female genital mutilation. Talk a little bit about how you got involved in this film and why you think it's important that it be seen.
Well, first of all, Frank, thank you for lending your platform on this important issue. It's not only about the circumstances impacting women in multiple Muslim majority and Muslim diaspora communities. It's also about the circumstances befalling girls. People often forget about little girls when they're talking about women, and those are perhaps the most vulnerable. Many of the practices that the movie discusses are part and parcel of being a woman or girl in certain Muslim-majority countries, but as an observant Muslim, I must renounce many of those practices as Islamic in any nature. I mean, you mentioned child marriage or forced marriage for one, for instance, or the concept of honor killing for another. The fundamental principle to be an authentic Muslim is the concept of free will. And free will is afforded to men and women. Many of the acts that our film carefully and explicitly depicts shows no opportunity for women or girls to express any kind of will. Honor killing is something that is empowered in many countries that we would consider otherwise advanced, for instance, Lebanon or Jordan, where legislation is very weak. So perpetrators of honor killings, who are often brothers or relatives of the victim, go very weakly prosecuted or not convicted at all. So there are many levels to this argument. And not only am I an observant Muslim, raised by Muslims, grandparents were also Muslim, but I practiced additionally medicine in Saudi Arabia, where some of the most orthodox theocracy exists. And you refer to a term called misogyny. I actually call it gender apartheid. A lot of countries are exercising gender apartheid in the name of Islam. We know this counter to be the ideal, and some of my most vociferous critics, who are Muslims themselves, who call me an apologist, I make no apology for the fact that the Quran expects equal observation of duties in men and women. That means prayer, charity, all of the five pillars that we could name. And for equal observation is equal reward. So there is no domination of one gender over the other legislated by Islam, as I understand it, and as many Muslim women understand it, who are actually living in these countries and battling for the rights of these women. I'm sure you're well aware of the world-famous lawyer, Asma Jahangir, in Pakistan, who prosecutes perpetrators of honor killings, who helps women escape marriages where they have been forced. Pakistan has actually got some of the richest experience in this kind of battle.
Dr. Ahmed, let me just drill down on one of these points, because I think something that you've just said is likely to be discordant with a lot of experts in Islam's experience, and certainly their assessment. Muhammad, as I understand it, is deemed to be the perfect Muslim. And in his life, of course, there was the practice of child marriage and his own statement about not cutting too deeply on the clitoris of women.
That's a statement I'm not aware of, so okay. I haven't read that reference, and I'd like to read it.
Well, I'll be happy to share it with you. The point is that in the traditions of Islam, as practiced in, among other places, the one you've written about and spent time in, of course, Saudi Arabia, these are very well-established traditions. And so when one hears that there is sort of no relation between them and Islam, or as a devout Muslim, you are rejecting them because of the choice that folks have, It sounds a little at odds with the reality that certainly many are experiencing.
What you're referring to that I haven't read specifically the reference sounds like an extraction from the Hadith. And what I go by is always the Quran supersedes the Hadith. Additionally, there is actually quite a vigorous debate. I can recommend to you an expert legal scholar who probably would be better informed than I on this issue about the legitimacy of female genital mutilation as part of Islamic interpretations of Sharia law. Now, nowhere in the Quran is female genital mutilation recommended or sanctioned, by which I mean made essential, nowhere. And additionally, you are quite right that in about 28 African countries, female genital mutilation is widespread. In a place like Somalia, it's almost universal. But it is not widespread or universal amongst 1.6 billion Muslims, of whom half would be women.
I think it is widespread. I don't know of any way to do a census on this, but for example, in the most populous of Muslim nations, Indonesia, apparently it is exceedingly widespread. So
that's not something I would agree on, because I just reviewed the figures from the WHO, and I refer you to my article that I published in The Independent. I could give you the scientific reference to that if you're interested.
I'd be very interested. I would be happy to share with you some other data that has been developed by Dr. Andrew Bostrom, for example. But the main point is not to get into the weeds on this, but simply to suggest that a film like Honor Diaries, which I think makes a very important contribution to our awareness of what is, whether authorized or not, whether formally, officially imbued with the stature of the Quranic teachings, is certainly part of, as you alluded to, the Hadiths, and therefore part of the broader Sharia practice in altogether too many places. And what I think you're describing in the film, to your credit, you and your other colleagues, is the concern that these practices are now beginning to manifest themselves in the West as well, including
in
countries like the United States where it's illegal.
That's absolutely true. When I'm talking to you about the prevalence of female genital mutilation, I'm not citing Islamic scholars. I'm citing medical investigators. And as a physician, I go based on the prevalence of the events, whether they're on the killings or whether they are female genital mutilation, based on scientific medical articles. So based on science, this is not a global phenomenon, but it is an arising prevalence in diaspora communities. While you are using terms like the Hadith and Sharia and are equating them to Islam, I'm talking to you about my understanding of Islam based on the Quran and what it means to be Islamic. There's no sanction for harming your child, and if I can quote myself, excavating her core sexual identity in the name of worship. And the person that you just cited, Dr. Andrew Bostrom, I don't see as a scientific expert on female genital mutilation.
No, but I think he's a well-recognized expert on Sharia and very much of the Islamic practices. And Doctor, I'm afraid we are out of time. I would love to continue this conversation with you, if I may, but for the moment we're hard-pressed. But let me just finish by saying, I think what you've just described is really at the root of the question that is vexing all of us, and that is, what is Sharia as it is formally enunciated by the authorities of the faith, and what is practiced by many, including like yourself, which is different. And I very much appreciate that difference and want very much to ensure that people make the distinction between problematic behavior, which typically is associated with Sharia, and that which is not evident in your own practice.
That's an excellent nuance that you've identified.
Thank you so much, Dr. Quanta Ahmed, one of the stars of Honor Diaries and author of In the Land of Invisible Women, A Female Doctor's Journey in the Saudi Kingdom. Next up, Bill Gertz takes us inside the ring.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Bill Gertz. He is the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and the author of the prize-winning column at the Washington Times, Inside the Ring. He takes us inside the ring each week, and it is always a revelation. Bill, you've had a very productive week in your various outlets, and I'm anxious to talk with you about several stories. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
You have given some attention, but it seems to me it's not gotten nearly what it requires from others, to the fact that the Russian Air Force sent an aircraft over an American warship in the Black Sea for some 90 minutes, 12 passes at low level, that amazingly, thanks to the restraint of the skipper of the U.S. ship, did not precipitate a conflict, actually. Talk a little bit about what you think the Russians are up to with that message sending, and more generally, what we're seeing out of them in connection with this campaign in Ukraine.
Well, this is clearly a military attempt at military intimidation by the Russians. It involved the U.S. guided missile warship Donald Cook that was sailing in the Black Sea, getting ready to make a stop in Romania to support our NATO ally there. And these two Su-24s flew over the ship. Only one of them did the buzzing 12 times at about 1,000 feet. This really pops the bubble of the Obama administration's policy delusion that the Russians are not an enemy and that we're living in some kind of globalized world where there are no threats. It was clearly intended to send a message to the U.S. military that this is Russian territory, and that the Russians were going to prevent the U.S. from exercising its freedom of navigation rights. The more troubling aspect is the military buildup that is taking place in the Black Sea in recently annexed Crimea. There's recent intelligence reports that the Russians are sending large numbers of T-72 tanks into the Crimea via rail, and that this is clearly getting ready to open up some kind of a military front, perhaps first from the east, where there's some 40 to 80,000 troops, and then from the south, from Crimea into Ukraine.
Bill, what do you think the Russians are making of the response of the United States to date? And just to use as a specific example, the claim by, I think it was a U.S. spokesman, that what the Russians were doing with these overflights was, quote, unprofessional, unquote, which I think is similar language to some that was used recently in another incident you recorded on the other side of the planet, where China sent a landing ship into the path of another American warship, very nearly causing a crash, and who knows what would have flowed from that. This isn't unprofessionalism, is it? This is deliberate and very calculated provocation.
And threatening. This kind of a response is very typical of the Obama administration's appeasement-oriented approach. In other words, there are no threats anywhere. And so when the Russians invaded Crimea, it was not a violation of sovereignty and democracy and freedom. It was a violation of international law, that kind of an approach. And clearly, calling the buzzing of a warship unprofessional, again, reeks of this weakness and appeasement approach to foreign affairs. Rather than sending a message of strength, the Obama administration prefers a message of weakness, and that has been the leading characteristic of its foreign policy.
One of the other examples of this weakness that you've described in your recent reporting, Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon and Washington Times, is an analysis done, a report, I guess, based on firsthand investigation by former four-star General Wesley Clark and Phil Carber of Georgetown University, that the administration is preventing even non-lethal aid from being provided to the Ukrainians, things like body armor, night vision goggles, radios, fuel, on the grounds that this is somehow destabilizing were it to be made available to the Ukrainians. What is going on with this? And again, how could the Russians interpret this as anything other than a green light for further aggression?
Absolutely correct. This was a very important study because of its bipartisan nature. Wes Clark and Phil Carber were invited to Ukraine, visited all the frontline units, and the main message that they received from the Ukrainian military is, we need this non-lethal aid. If you're not going to send us lethal aid, and they had a five-page request of both lethal and non-lethal aid, 80% of which was rejected by the Obama administration as somehow provocative. The Pentagon has applied some criteria to this non-lethal aid that it considers a force multiplier, thus giving them night vision goggles and body armor to block Russian snipers that are killing their officers is somehow considered provocative of Russia. Again, it's this weakness and appeasement approach to national security affairs.
it would seem to me, and we were talking with Herman Pirchner earlier in the program, I think he would very strongly agree that force multiplying is exactly what we should be doing to help the Ukrainians who've had their military essentially emasculated at the behest of Russia over the past decade or so, to be a more formidable deterrent to this kind of aggression, lest we find ourselves with that invasion seems to be in the offing now taking place. We know less about it than we might otherwise, Bill Gertz, as you've reported at the Free Beacon, because the Russians have objected to our exercising a right we have under the so-called Open Skies Treaty to overfly some of these sorts of areas at precisely a moment when it would be useful to be able to have the kind of intelligence that we could collect as a result about the order of battle and the size of the force and its disposition on the Russian side of the Ukrainian border. What's up with that?
That's right, Frank. This is a big scoop in the Free Beacon today that the Russians have denied a treaty approved, that is the Open Skies Treaty, overflight of Russian territory. These flights have been carried out weekly for the past month, and all of a sudden this week, the Russians said, no, you cannot overfly. And this is in addition to being yet another treaty violation by the Russians, it's a bad sign in that it is trying to block the U.S. and NATO from monitoring large-scale Russian troop movements, both on the eastern border of Ukraine as well as in the western part of Russia towards the eastern European side. This was the State Department issued a non-denial denial saying that, well, it was a weather flight that what couldn't be carried out in time. Well, I checked the weather map there. There was no, the skies were clear over the entire Russian country. And yet they allowed the Russians to cancel this overflight. Now we still have satellite coverage and electronic coverage, but the Ukrainians desperately need that kind of aerial surveillance to figure out what these troops are doing. And the Pentagon has said the Russian troops have been running up to the border and staging and then moving back a few kilometers. Clearly, they're not just doing exercises. They're really prepared to get ready for some invasion. So that's why these overflights are important, but yet the Russians now have blocked them.
Yeah. Two quick points, Bill. That weather is the only legitimate basis upon which these flights can be canceled, as I understand it. And secondly, is it still the case, Bill, that we are not sharing intelligence about what the Russians are doing, I guess on the grounds that that would also be provocative to give that information to the Ukrainians?
There have been reports to that effect. And also, I would note that the White House confirmed the visit to Ukraine recently by CIA Director John Brennan, which to me signals that they're giving some intelligence. And I'm certain that they, as a partner in the Open Skies Treaty, the Russians, the Ukrainians will receive intelligence from that's gathered from those overflights in the past. But that's one of the reasons they're important.
I see. Even if we chose to withhold it, they would still gain access to it through other quarters.
Yes.
Bill, thank you for this quick update. It only is, unfortunately, a fraction of what you've reported on this week. We've got to talk with you next week about this Russian intercontinental ballistic missile program, the modernization of their nuclear forces, and how it contrasts with what we're doing, which is to say, not very bloody much. But that's another day's conversation. We look forward to talking with you next week. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you as well next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Thank you.